It's The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward, in for Kate Archer-Kent. Manoman, or wild rice, has been a spiritual, cultural, and culinary staple for Wisconsin tribes for thousands of years. The methods for the rice harvest now underway have remained unchanged for centuries, using non-motorized boats during restricted hours. In addition to its cultural significance, the wild rice harvest also marks the time of year to gather in celebration, give thanks, and reflect. Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kathy Smith is an enrolled member of the Keweenaw Bay Indian Community of the Lake Superior Band of Chippewa Indians. She is the Janawandong Manoman, or she who takes care of the wild rice at the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission Biological Service Division. Kathy, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Bonjour.
Ha! It's so good to hear from you, and I'm looking forward to this conversation. This position is new in the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. What is the goal?
Well, the goal is that I work with our precious gift, Manoman. I actually work with 11 member tribes in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, where I assist with implementing the Glyphic Manoman Stewardship Program. We also provide education and outreach, where wild rice is of great cultural significance to its member tribes. And Glyphic focuses on the preservation and enhancement of wild rice and ceded territory water bodies. I also work with the rice chiefs throughout the ceded territory, where we provide expertise and public information to partners through research partnership and supports tribal members to ensure treaty rights are exercised. So we try our best to protect and enhance the Manoman through restoration. This position is unique as it incorporates traditional knowledge and culture. And I've worked with Glyphic for almost a year as I came on in mid-September in 2021. I'm also an advocate for Nibi, which means water through ceremony and prayer, where I facilitate two annual water walks in the Keweenaw Peninsula using the Anishinaabe protocol, where those water walks are open for everyone.
Where does the word come from, Manoman?
Manoman is in a word in Ojibwe Mo'win, which means the good berry. It's also known as wild rice. Wild rice is an aquatic annual grass. So Anishinaabe people had settled in the Great Lakes Basin. And because of wild rice, you know, which it grows in various water bodies and it fulfills our prophecy.
I understand that in your position, you are surveying wild rice production. So what is your evaluation so far? How does that work?
So we do aerial surveys and ground surveys. So I'll explain a little bit about the aerial surveys first, which are, we conduct them by flying over, you know, various water bodies. We do approximately 4 flights throughout the ceded territory. And of course, it's weather dependent. The less clouds, the better. So we fly over the Manadu Gitagon, which means the spirit gardens. So Manoman water bodies are assessed from the air, which are given an overview of conditions for the upcoming season. We were trained by Peter David himself, as he's one of our mentors, as it is quite the art to fly with the eagles, the Migiziwug, and we overlook the landscape. From the air, we could see all of the connecting water bodies throughout the ceded territory. From the eagle point of view, it helps expedite surveys through aerial photography to see that the rice beds, you know, and what we can do in such a short time frame. It's very fascinating. We can get a good number to assess the beds, which will be harvestable. We use the rating system of very good, the good, average, fair, and poor. From the sky, we can look at the wild rice with its distinct texture, color. From the air, where we can see it. We can evaluate and look at the approximate size of the rice beds and overall condition. We can actually tell if brown spot disease is prevalent and even see other encroaching vegetation such as cattails. These photos are then posted to our website at glyphic.org. You can look at the harvest outlook along with other relevant information. So with these photos, we also assist rice chiefs with determining rice waters that can be open and closed for the season. Especially of the date-regulated lakes. When the rice beds are ready for harvest, signs are posted 24 hours before opening, and signs will be posted when they are closed for the season. So we could see different things from the air and have a history of aerial photos where we can compare year after year. Also with the ground surveys, we call it ground truthing, where we can see the abundance and density through meter square assessment, where we can measure the height of the wild rice itself. We count the many stalks and see what stage the rice is during development. We can learn a great amount of information by looking at water depth, clarity, other plant species, as far as the competition. We also look for brown spot disease or rice worms that can compromise, the plants. So sometimes you can even tell if the plants have ghost husks, which can indicate much rain in a short period of time during pollination, or even a big wind event that can compromise the pollination by laying down the rice, during the flowering stage. So a lot of grazing has been observed in ground surveys and can create an issue by resident geese and swans. Swans can actually be seen from the air surveys as well.
So fascinating. We're talking about the wild rice harvest season underway. Kathy Smith works in the Biological Service Division at the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. You talked a little bit about the cultural importance, and I want to hear a little bit more about that. Why is the wild rice so important to the Ojibwe people?
So the cultural significance of our food, it's so such a spiritual food, because we believe that it's given to us from Gitche Manitou, the creator. So we have places around Gitche Gaming, which is Lake Superior. So I could tell a little bit of about the migration story. So about 1,000 years ago, our ancestors were living in the northeastern part of the United States. We have three groups of the people that refer to themselves as Anishinaabe. They would share the closely related Algonquin language. We are known today as the Ojibwe, the Potawatomi, and the Odawa peoples. Through the migration, from the Atlantic, we were separated and we went our own ways. The region to the east had a real dense indigenous population, was greater than all of the Western Europe at that time. So the increasingly crowded conditions led to clashes for power as different groups competed for territory and resources. At about this time, according to the Ojibwe oral history, seven prophets visited the people and instructed them to move westward to where the food grows on the water. The prophets warned, "If you do not move, you will be destroyed." So some left and some people stayed. The Anishinaabe who chose to leave began a slow migration westward in small groups over a period of 100 years, hundreds of years, I should say. They followed a meteor shell in the sky. So this history is traced through oral history and preserved in maps of birch bark, and was known as the Seven Fires Prophecy. So they traced a path from the St. Louis River to the Central Great Lakes. So it wasn't until the 1700s that Ojibwe families landed in the western shore of Lake Superior and began moving into the northern Minnesota. So by this time, Ojibwe communities were located on the sides of Gitche Gaming, as well as Lake Huron, the Georgian Bay, north side of Lake Ontario. So throughout this journey, the Ojibwe stayed close to, connected to the water, where they sustained their families by fishing and hunting. They also cared for one another by organizing their families within the clan system. So Ojibwe people accepted roles in society based on their clans and were groomed for certain jobs. So politics, medicine, and scouts and protectors, for example. So by the mid-1900s, the Ojibwe people in Gitche Gaming had around 20 clans, and most people, the members were the crane, catfish, the mukwa, the bear, marten, mayingan, which is the wolf, or loon families. So this is how we are today. So we're returning to our ways as the prophecies have foretold. So we're gently reminded of our ways. So with Manoman, being of cultural significance, it's so revered in our culture and our ways to, we use them in our feast today. Through for ceremonies and especially through naming ceremonies and funerals.
Kathy, knowing what this means to you as a whole, as a people, what does it mean to you personally to be so closely tied to this harvest?
It's so Anishinaabeg, it's we actually have such a great connection that it's actually a feeling. So sometimes it's really hard to kind of describe, how we feel about a certain resource, especially Manoman. So it's near and dear to my heart because I've been a part of, wild rice restoration for a number of years now, and I have so many wonderful teachers. And you learn so much because you learn constantly Even though you hear the same story over and over again or the same teachings, you always pick something up that's different. So my personal connection with Mnomon is that for a long time, I lived away from home. And once I came back and started learning about the medicines, the Meskhiki and where Mnomon is one of them. And it's just a beautiful way of how our culture brings a sense of community, our people together, through harvesting. And harvesting Mnomon is a year-round process.
And I'm going to
So
ask you
it's
about, I want to ask you about that process after we pause for just a moment. Kathy Smith works at the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission in the Biological Service Division. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Shereen Seward. As the wild rice harvest season continues, we're talking today about the cultural significance of this food and its long history in Wisconsin. Join in on the climate challenges these crops now face and what can be done to mitigate those effects. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kathy Smith is an enrolled tribal member with the Keweenaw Bay Indian community of the Lake Superior Band of Chippewa Indians. She is the Janawandong Mnomon, or she who takes care of the wild rice at the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. Kathy, just before we took a pause, we talked a little bit about, you mentioned the harvest season and how the process is. I want to hear about that. What is the process of harvesting like?
So August is known for the rice making moon. So it signals the impending wild rice harvest season. So this is the time when you actually get your equipment ready. So it's a year-long process when you do that. So Labor Day weekend is usually a target when I start looking here in a northern region. Different waters depend on locations where it's weather dependent, and it can vary in temperatures by sediment type, water depth, and other factors. So peak time is usually around mid-September. But it's, of course, that's according to Mama Aki, when everything is in alignment and ready. So this is when the rice will start ripening. So it ripens at a gradual uneven rate, between 10 to 14 day period. So it can be harvested repeatedly during the season. As you hand harvest, some of the seed is actually falling into the water as you harvest. So it's a reciprocal relationship that we have, with giving back. So when it rains, some rice chiefs will put a limit of 2 to 3 days afterward before you can go into the rice beds again. And this is usually when the rice, can fall back. And so into the sediment, so it can rest in the muck. It needs to know winter, so it goes through seasonal changes. So as Mnomon seeds, we do know that in the springtime it'll bring new life. So we do practice an honorable harvest. So when you do capture wild rice by harvesting by hand, it's usually 10 to 15% that you get. An acre of rice can yield up to 500 pounds of rice, and you can typically harvest up to 100 pounds of green seed for sustenance, and you will actually get 40 pounds of finished rice. So the traditional way of harvesting, we use knockers. You cannot get them more than 38 in length. You must use smooth so it does not harm the rice. Push poles, will actually propel you along in a canoe, and they have a hardwood fork. You have paddles, a canoe that can be no longer than 17 feet and no wider than 38 inches. So there's no mechanical means like a motor that can be used, as it can damage the rice bed. So you always make sure you have your PFDs and in your bags to hold your precious food source. So only legal residents of Wisconsin can harvest wild rice within the state. So if you're a Wisconsin resident at the age of 17 and 64, you could purchase a wild rice harvester license to harvest wild rice in a lake or a publicly owned waterbed within the waterway. So a free wild rice ID card may be issued to immediate families of our licensed ricer or recipients of elders who need assistance. So how you can obtain a harvest permit or ID is you can go to gowildwisconsin.gov or any DNR license plates agent through the state. So throughout ceded territory, we do have date regulated lakes that are posted on the glyphic site. And with the guidance from tribal chiefs, these waters are that are not date regulated, you can harvest at any time. You will need permission on reservation lands and limited to tribal members, and they can vary. So you also need permission from private landowners. So hours of harvesting are usually between the hours of 10 a.m. to sunset. So the proper technique for harvesting wild rice is that you gently pull the rice plants over the canoe with one stick and gently tap seed heads over the canoe with the stick of the opposite hand. So it's a gentle way of being able to, get the mature seed into your canoe. So you got to make sure that you bend them, you don't break them. So if you're breaking them, that's too much force. That's being applied with the sticks. So, it's a continuing process as you're propelled through the rice beds. So the processed rice, we actually spread them out and dry them on tarps to get rid of all the moisture so it does not form any kind of mildew. And then after that process, we actually parched it by slowly roasting to destroy the germ, but not the kind that you think. So when that process is done, then we actually hull them. So we do it by jigging or dancing the rice in a hole. We put little bits at a time. So we dance the rice to get the husks off. So we use poles and we dig a hole in place in a tarp and use moccasins and kind of do the twist. So after that process, then we winnow the rice to remove the chaff, and then we actually store the rice, and then you can store it for a long time.
We're talking about the traditional wild rice harvest with Kathy Smith. She works in the Biological Service Division at the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. She is a Janawandong Manoman. That is a title in the Ojibwe language that means she who takes care of wild rice. Kathy, scientists say extreme weather like flooding may become more common with climate change. How has flooding affected wild rice production in the past?
So over the long term, we always think of many things that impact Manoman. With the climate change, the threats to Manoman are higher, the humidity levels and fluctuation in our water depths beyond our plant relatives' critical thresholds. So water depth is critical for all growth stages of Manoman and has significantly increased throughout the region, where periods of prolonged high water levels, prevent seed germination, and spring flooding actually uproots the young plants during the floating leaf stage. So if we have a high rain event, that can really compromise the plant. So observations of plants, following flood events can show decrease in stem length and diameter and reduces in flow numbers. So flooding can actually reduce water quality due to agricultural runoff, which can increase brown spot fungus, weaken the plant stems, reduce the plant height. So in the Midwest, it's actually expected to experience a higher, warmer season temperature and frost free seasons that are predicted to increase by 10 days in this century alone. So as a result, we have, even water surface temperatures in the Great Lakes that are predicted to rise at least 7 degrees by 2050 due to drastic precipitation and temperature changes to Manoman, where it has seemed to be most vulnerable species, throughout the ceded territory. So with even flooding, Bad River had a big flooding event in 2016, but this year the rice is abundant.
Okay, what about PFAS or those forever chemicals? Do you worry about that, the toxins in the water, when it comes to wild rice?
So when it comes to wild rice, of course, we, have great concerns. So we actually have plans in place to where we're, helping partners apply for grants to do a study, especially with wild rice. So that hasn't really been visited yet, but it's in the plans for finding out what PFAS does to Manoman.
What can people in Wisconsin do to better support a healthy environment for wild rice beds and ensure that this crop continues?
So they could learn about the medicines about the wild rice itself. Usually I tell people to go out and sit with them. You can learn a lot by watching the plants. You can learn a lot from education outreach programs, especially through Wisconsin DNR. They have some wonderful programs, and you can actually, contact tribes. You can contact GLFIC, of course, because there is many rice camps where you can actually attend that, are open for everyone. So for example, up in Keweenaw Bay, this starting Wednesday throughout Labor Day weekend, we have a rice camp that's open for everyone where they could do their part to learn about this precious resource as far as how to make the tools and how to process the rice. So everybody could do their own part by actually, being very mindful of around the plants. And if you don't understand them, learn about them. So the best way is to really, just learn about, this precious resource and what it can do for you. So we have this ongoing
Sure.
reciprocal relationship to the lands and the environment.
Kathy, I want to thank you for joining us and sharing all of this with us today.
Oh, Miigwech for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Kathy Smith is an enrolled tribal member with the Keweenaw Bay Indian Community of the Lake Superior Band of Chippewa Indians. She is surveying wild rice production for the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission Biological Service Division. Up ahead, we speak with a leader at one of Wisconsin's largest employers, Epic Systems of Verona. The company is seeking to reshape healthcare while caring for the medical records of more than 250 million people. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Shireen Seward. News update is next on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Shireen Seward, in for Kate Archer Kent. Being a chief executive in Wisconsin has an array of challenges, some of which were exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. The morning show has been reaching out to local CEOs to hear about those challenges and their successes to better understand the business climate in Wisconsin. Our guest today is Dr. Jackie Gerhart, who is Vice President of Clinical Informatics at Epic, where she works with healthcare executives to advance clinical care and improve clinician well-being. She is also an Associate Professor of Family Medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health and practices medicine at UW Health. Join in with your questions about Epic, which holds health records for millions of Americans. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Welcome to the Ideas Network.
Great. Thanks, Shireen.
Did I pronounce your last name correctly? I have to ask you.
You did.
Okay, good. I was a little concerned there. More than 250 million people have records in Epic Systems. This provides software for hospitals, doctors, and other healthcare providers. Can you give an overview of what Epic software does?
Yes. So Epic was started in 1979 by founder Judy Faulkner with 1.5 employees in a basement of an apartment building in Madison, Wisconsin, and has now grown to over 12,000 employees today, with 11,000 of them living in the Verona, Wisconsin area. And it is our job to make sure that the healthcare software that people are using in hospitals, clinics, and that patients are using on their phones via MyChart, which is the patient app, that is usable and allows everyone to get the information they need to advance clinical care at the point of care.
Healthcare record keeping has changed significantly in recent decades. Can you talk about that a little bit? How records are being kept electronically now that, a few years ago would have been unheard of?
So we now have patient records on the computer primarily. It's pretty rare to find a office or clinic that has them on paper anymore. And that's been really helpful, not only from seeing patients on a daily basis so that you can find the information that's critical to take care of them, but also to help give insight. So for example, if there's a patient that tested positive for COVID-19, I don't need to sift through their paper record to try to find that test result. It is shown to me right up front so that I can make the accurate decisions and medical advice that I need for that specific patient.
And who subscribes to Epic software? What kinds of systems are we talking about?
There's about 621 customers in the U.S. and across 15 countries. And these are health systems that can be federally qualified health centers up to very large academic organizations and often multi-state entities as well. So it's a good chance that if you're seeing taking care in the United States that you're going to be encountering Epic at some point.
We're talking about Epic Systems with the top executive at the company, Vice President of Clinical Informatics, Dr. Jackie Gerhart. We have Tom with us now from Burlington on the phone. Hello, Tom.
Well, I'd like to ask the question, how come it took so long for the hospitals or the medical profession in general to get digitalized, to get up with putting this stuff on computers and things. It seems when you transfer from one hospital to another, they have to retake the test that the hospital has already taken. And it seems like, what's the background of this problem?
Thank you. Thanks, Tom. Jackie, what do you say to Tom's question? What took so long?
It has been a journey to change the informatics structure throughout the country. As you can imagine, when we were on paper, there are many different systems that need to be put in place to get everyone electronic. And so from the patient end, it might look like it takes, you know, many, many days to get a record versus when you're online and when you actually are using the electronic record, it can take a matter of minutes or even seconds. So nowadays, I would hope that you're having the experience that you can get your information potentially right on your phone using your MyChart app. The journey to get here has been long, mostly because healthcare IT is very complicated. And so when you think about digitizing and doing technology for different types of industries, healthcare, you need to really get it right. The data needs to be very accurate so that you make the correct diagnosis and do the right treatment.
How has this practice changed, transformed really the way that doctors and clinics treat their patients when it comes to this modern data collection practice?
We have the right data that we need at the right time, and that allows us to put forward different treatment options for patients that maybe we wouldn't have otherwise thought of if we didn't have all of the data there. Our founder and CEO, Judy Faulkner, actually gives a story of her husband, Gordon, who is a pediatrician, who early on when Epic was first being founded, his story was that he had a child who was being treated in another state and just didn't have the information that that provider needed in order to give the appropriate treatment for the patient. And the patient ended up dying, actually. And so really, this can be life-saving if we can get the right information in front of the providers to do the right treatment.
How integrated is the healthcare system becoming? I mean, Epic software connects various levels of the healthcare system, doctors, specialists, pharmacists, insurers. So how much has this changed? How integrated is it now?
Very integrated. And hopefully that's the experience. When I'm in an exam room and looking at a chart in Epic, I'm able to see information from multiple different healthcare organizations and also information that the patient entered themselves. And so this allows for much more of a robust treatment plan and journey for that patient. And I think the biggest benefit for patients is that not only do they have access to their healthcare information, but they have access to their healthcare team. So they can send a message, request refills, and some of the basic things that would have taken a longer process before are now much more automated. And that's really important in as we are more a consumer-driven society, that people find healthcare to be just as easily accessible as other activities.
Anytime things are in a central location or when things are at your fingertips, there will always be privacy concerns. So how does Epic work to ensure that sensitive patient data avoids falling into the wrong hands?
We have multiple ways to do that. The first of which is at an organization level, whenever a patient is asking to receive care, they sign a consent form that includes what happens to their information in terms of interoperability and data exchange. So Epic has an interoperability platform called Care Everywhere. And the goal of Care Everywhere is to help clinicians across the country be able to see information from records that were collected elsewhere. And so as part of that signed agreement that patients will do when they're seeking care, that information is allowed to cross ways from one organization to the other. Now that doesn't, it's a HIPAA, it's protected by HIPAA. And so it doesn't allow for that information to go to an entity that is not protected by HIPAA. So it's healthcare organization to healthcare organization, and the patient can access it as well.
So we know what's supposed to happen. And obviously, what's supposed to happen is that patient data should be protected no matter what. If a data breach does happen, though, then what steps are taken? What happens next?
At Epic, we have a cybersecurity team, and we also have multiple folks that are working around the clock to make sure that data breaches do not happen. In the case that something like that would, we would work directly with the healthcare organization to make sure we could understand the problem. And we have a philosophy of all hands on deck, so we would immediately jump into action to make sure that any risk that could be associated with that was minimized.
I want to ask you a little bit about the partnerships that you have with other companies. Epic partners with some medical testing companies, Exact Scientists and Myriad Genetics. Both companies develop tests to detect indicators for cancers and other illnesses. How do those partnerships benefit consumers?
The Exact Sciences test that probably is most well known is Cologuard, and that's a colon cancer screening test that people can use often instead of a colonoscopy. And how that benefits consumers is that not only is the test helpful, but then the information from the test can go directly into the workflow for the provider. So if the test is a negative result, it's not that they need to look at a paper record or a fax. It's right in their electronic health system, right in their Epic for them to view. And then decision support can be based on that. So if the test is positive, it can be offered to then get next steps, such as a colonoscopy or a GI appointment. But there's one other piece to this, which is exciting and new, which is as we work more with our customers that have cancer centers and also work more with some of the diagnostic and therapeutic companies, there is this opportunity to be able to share information about different clinical trials. So oftentimes, about only 3% of people that are eligible for a clinical trial will actually be able to find a clinical trial or even know where to go. And so, one of our goals with partnering with other companies is to help bring those opportunities not only to the organizations that may have patients that are eligible, but also directly to the patients so that they are able to either use those therapeutics or get signed up for a trial.
Dr. Jackie Gerhardt is the Vice President of Clinical Informatics at Epic, based in Verona. She is also an Associate Professor of Family Medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. She practices medicine at UW Health as well. Join in this discussion. 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Shereen Seward. The health software company Epic Systems, based in Verona, is using lessons learned from the COVID-19 pandemic in its approach to care coordination and virtual care for health systems nationwide. Join in on what the future holds for healthcare in Wisconsin and beyond. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Jackie Gerhardt is Vice President of Clinical Information at Epic. She also practices at UW Health. Jackie, we had a caller who could not stay with us, Elizabeth from Verona. We talked a little bit about data breaches before, and she was wanting to know how Epic protects from hackers and what would happen if a hacker were to hold information hostage, for example.
Great question. Very similar to the description from before, our plan would be to work directly with the organization that experienced the breach. So, as we look where that data is held, we would then determine with that organization what was actually affected and who might have access to that data. And then, in an event like that, we would work directly with that person that's at the organization that's in cybersecurity, and then use our cybersecurity team here as well. And so the goal would be to, of course, protect data as much as possible in the event that that would happen.
We also had a caller, Matt from Ashland. Matt says is a family doctor and does not use Epic. Matt is asking how Epic works with other medical records from other hospitals and what inter-office communications look like, Jackie.
Interoffice communications can be done in a variety of ways. In Epic, we often will use Secure Chat, which allows me to message back and forth with my team, my clinical nurses, et cetera. We also have an in-basket tool, which allows for any information from, say, a hospital, like a discharge summary, et cetera, to be put into that person's inbox that's very similar to email, so that any information that happens for that patient in an area that's not in their specific clinic can be sent directly there. In terms of non-Epic organizations, the U.S. has interoperability standards. And so no matter what organization you are at, Epic or non-Epic, there is a minimum set that needs to be exchanged between different organizations. That includes things called USCDI, which is the United States core data set for interoperability. And that allows us to make sure that we're taking care of patients with the right information, going way back to the question about paper. On paper, we didn't have that, where exchange wasn't necessary. And so it's much better nowadays.
Jackie, you were involved in Epic's response to the COVID pandemic. The pandemic just posed incredible challenges that that affected health systems nationwide. What is your company doing to help fight the pandemic? And what did you learn from that whole experience?
During that experience, we were all hands on deck. As you can imagine, the tech industry needed to be very at the ready to try to get all different flows throughout COVID to be able to be more seamless. But the healthcare tech industry was so paramount, because getting things turned on like telemedicine and surge centers and vaccination protocols and so forth was really something that needed to happen at lightning speed, much faster than we've really ever implemented something in healthcare before. And so most of the employees here really felt a duty of, we need to be supporting these frontline workers. And really, it's our job to make sure that they have the information that they need to be able to take care of their patients. One example, we helped expand to the USNS ship off of New York, so that the folks there could use iPads that then had the Kanto app, which is Epic's app for the tablet, and it allowed them to see the record that the patient otherwise would have had at a different healthcare organization in that pop-up facility to be able to provide care for COVID.
Looking back now, could you ever have imagined that something like this would happen, that would transform the way healthcare is provided in America? The shift to telehealth and, you know, all of those things happened, as you said, kind of a record speed. Could you have imagined that before this? And I mean, is this just going to be the norm from now on?
We did imagine it before, and we tried to get telehealth live at many organizations even before the pandemic, but it really took an event similar to the pandemic where people were almost forced to try to change their practice of medicine into a different way that might be more novel or just less familiar. And the telemedicine surge was really amazing to see in the beginning, and I'm hopeful that it continues. One of the reasons that we were able to do it so much is because the CMS reimbursement and insurance reimbursement allowed for that type of care to be provided. And so as we go forward and potentially are not in a pandemic era, we are hopeful that that will continue, because really it's actually broken down many barriers and helped with healthcare access for people, especially in even rural environments that maybe wouldn't be able to get to a clinic or a healthcare facility. That is huge for them. And so really looking forward to using technology to bring people together from an access perspective, as well as just a convenience perspective.
Dr. Jackie Gerhardt is the Vice President of Clinical Informatics at Epic, where she works with healthcare executives to advance clinical care and improve clinician well-being. What communication does Epic have with regulatory agencies like the Federal Centers for Disease Control or the State Health Department, for example?
During the pandemic, we were much more closely aligned with public health authorities. So specifically in the state of Wisconsin, we had project managers that worked directly at the Department of Health Services for Wisconsin and essentially helped them with their data flow, making sure that we could get labs in a timely fashion, that the vaccinations had a seamless rollout. And so really very much boots on the ground, elbow to elbow in that situation. On a national level, we also worked with the CDC and others on data collection, because oftentimes data in public health right now is a little bit siloed or could take longer time to get to the right people. And so at Epic, with having, you know, over the number of patient of MyChart accounts that we have is 155 million, but we also have a database called Cosmos, which has over 162 million patient records in it. And this is a HIPAA-defined limited data set where we can do research, and so can any Cosmos participant. And the goal is to get good information out quickly. And so much of our work that we did with the CDC during the pandemic was to say, all right, in the last 2 weeks, in the last month, who's been hospitalized? What were their results? How did that change if they had previously had COVID? And we actually published an MMWR along with the CDC on vaccine effectiveness in people who previously did get an infection. So really working with federal authorities has been very helpful to pass on good information quickly from real world data, which may not have otherwise been accessible at that time.
You oversee Epic's studies. What is Epic researching? What are you excited about?
The most recent study we did just this past week was on fentanyl testing. So as you might know, fentanyl is the number one reason for death in people that overdose in ages 18 to 45. And we in emergency departments often are not testing for it. So that makes it difficult to know exactly how much of a public health problem it is. We may be underestimating it. So we looked to see out of all of the overdoses within Cosmos, how many of those patients were tested for fentanyl, and only about 5% were. But in the 5% that were, almost 50% came back positive. And so we think that there is a huge opportunity from a public health perspective to start increasing testing of fentanyl, not just doing sort of a basic toxicology screen, which really kind of came out in the 80s of a typical 5 tests that you might do, but following best practices and being able to add that in to better understand the public health problem.
In the final 30 seconds that we have left, what other research would you like to see Epic tackle in the future?
One that I'm excited about that we keep coming back to is the cancer screening rates and then what will happen from that. So as you can imagine, as clinics shut down during the pandemic, people didn't get their normal mammograms or their normal pap smears. Mm-hmm. And so we've been tracking how often people are getting screened throughout the entire pandemic. And it will be interesting to see what happens. Our hope is that most of those people were able to get right back in and get their tests again, and that any early cancers were detected. But it'll be interesting to see if there's any change in the number of cancers or the stage at which those cancers are found.
Thank you so much for joining us and sharing this with us. Dr. Jackie Gerhart is the Vice President of Clinical Informatics at Epic. She is also an Associate Professor of Family Medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health and practices medicine at UW Health. Coming up, we speak with a UW Health researcher on the deadly combination of meth and opioid drug use. Then a dramatic rise in families homeschooling their children continues in Wisconsin. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.